Hello again, this is Tristan Teed and the Classics Book Club. This week's book review is Thomas Hardy's Far From the Madding Crowd. Far From the Madding Crowd has to be Thomas Hardy's most famous book, and it could be argued his most well-beloved. The themes within the book are themes of love, revenge, folly, vanity, true goodness, or pretense. Now, those are varying themes that we can look at in the book. However, the main theme is derived from where the book gets its name, Far From the Madding Crowd. Madding means frenzied, so far from the frenzied crowd. And the book title is taken from a poem called Elegy Written in a Country Churchyard. In the poem, the poet is describing how whether we are high or lowly in birth, whether we've commanded armies or all we've done is work a farm, we all end up in the grave. It's like the phrase, like lightning flashes in the cloud, we live but in the flicker. Now, partway through the poem, speaking of the dead, the poet says, far from the madding crowd's ignoble strife, their sober wishes never learn to stray. Just read that again. Far from the madding crowd's ignoble strife, there, that's those who are dead now, sober wishes never learn to stray. And this is a theme so important for all human beings because, like we said, we live in the flicker. We all want true happiness. We all want the best out of our lives. And yet, how often are we distracted one way or the other by the frivolities of life? And the sobriety of life, the things that truly work out for our advantage, are the things that we don't focus on enough. And at death, we have found that our sober wishes, we never learn to stray away from the frenzied crowd, the madding crowd, in order to get our sober wishes. And that is the theme of Thomas Hardy's Far From the Madding Crowd. So, a little about the plot. The plot revolves around the central heroine, Bathsheba Everdeen. And before we tell the story, I'd like to introduce you to her as she's introduced in the book. Listen to this. Gabriel Oak, the other main character, sees her from a distance as she's coming along in a cart with a wagoner, with a load of household utensils, chairs upturned, and tables and the like in the wagon. And she says something's been dropped from the wagon. So the wagoner gets out and he vanishes. And then this is how she is first seen by Gabriel Oak. The handsome girl waited for some time idly in her place, and the only sound heard in the stillness was the hopping of the canary up and down the perches of its prison. Then she looked attentively downwards. It was not the bird, nor at the cat. It was at an oblong package tied in paper and lying between them. She turned her head to see if the wagoner was coming. He was not yet in sight, and her eyes crept back to the package. Her thoughts seemed to run upon what was inside it. At length, she drew the article into her lap and untied the paper covering. A small swing looking glass was disclosed, in which she proceeded to survey herself attentively. She parted her lips and smiled. That's our introduction to the heroine of the book, Far From the Madding Crowd, Bathsheba Everdeen. And you can see from the off that she has a touch of vanity about her, a frivolity, as it were. She wants to reflect on her beauty, knowing that she could be attractive to other men. However, she's not a vapid character. Bathsheba Everdeen is quite educated and very self-composed. And later in the book, you find that she inherits a farm, and she has no intent, just because she is a woman, of being pushed about by men. She intends to run the farm for herself. So she's quite educated, she's very self-willed, she's very capable. However, the story will revolve around three men who all would like her hand in marriage. The first is Gabriel Oak, who we're introduced to in the first chapter. The second is an older gentleman farmer, a neighbour of Batchelor Everdeen's, called Boldwood. And the third is a sergeant in the army called Troy. The book revolves around these three wanting her attentions, and it gets us to analyse what is truly important in a character. It gets us to analyse the madding crowd, the frenzies of life, against the more sober interests. Now, to start with, Gabriel Oak has trying to build himself a bit of wealth. He's got enough money to get a flock, but through no fault of his own, his entire flock gets run off a cliff, essentially, by his sheepdog, and he's left destitute, and so has to go to work again, not for himself, but for someone else. And as it happens, he goes to work at Bathsheba Everdeen's farm. But before this, he had already told her that he'd like her hand in marriage. And she had talked about how nice it was, despite the fact that she had no intention whatsoever of marrying him. It was just her frivolous nature and her vanity to listen to him talk so. But once she's turned him down, Gabriel Oak doesn't bring that topic up again and humbly works for her and for her interests, because he loves her deeply, but he's never going to ask her to marry him again. A little later, we meet another man called Boldwood. Now, he's not looking to marry, but in her frivolous way, Bathsheba Everdeen, in one thoughtless act which haunts her for the rest of the book, writes him a Valentine's card. Roses are red, violets are blue, carnations sweet, and so are you. And again, she has no intention of marrying this Boldwood. However, it stirs up in him these really strong feelings, and he begins to think over and over about Bathsheba until he quite convinces himself that she loves him and he loves her. And that's when we first run into a bit of trouble for Bathsheba, and when we see the natures of the madding crowd, the frenzied crowd, because Boldwood's way of dealing with Bathsheba, although he's educated and very well to do, she doesn't love him. However, he can't take no for an answer. Just listen to this little snippet of conversation between the two of them. Bathsheba has told him that she didn't really mean the Valentine. However, she says this: "I feel, Mr. Boldwood, that though I respect you much, I do not feel what would justify me to in accepting your offer," she stammered. Boldwood replies, "My life is a burden without you," he exclaimed in a low voice. "I want you. I want you to let me say I love you again and again. I think and hope you care enough for me to listen to what I have to tell." "I wish I could say courteous flatteries to you," the farmer continued in an easier tone, "and put my rugged feeling into a graceful shape. But I have neither power nor patience to learn such things. I want you for my wife so wildly that no other feeling can abide in me. But I should not have spoken out had I not been led to hope." So here we see, first of all, the folly of what Bathsheba's done in sending this Valentine. She's awakened a love in this Boldwood, and he really pursues her, and he just keeps on hammering until he finally breaks her down to say that she'll at least consider marrying him at some point. And for him, that's good enough. In fact, to him, that's almost as good as a contract. So we've got one nature here. We've got someone who has wealth, education, but his manner thinks a lot of only his own interests. Later on, Bathsheba meets a third character, Sergeant Troy. Now, speaking of Sergeant Troy, when he meets her, he's a dashing, infantryman, sergeant, and he has a way with women, quite particular. And this is what the book says about the other side of human nature. It says, "The wondrous power of flattery in passados at woman is a perception so universal as to be remarked upon by many people almost as automatically as they repeat a proverb." You see, Troy, Sergeant Troy, bombards Bathsheba Everdeen with unadulterated flattery. He calls her the queen of the corn market because she goes to the market herself instead of sending another man from her farm. She wants to run her farm. So he calls her the queen of the corn market. He tells her she's beautiful. And when she objects, he says, "Oh, intolerable times, that ill luck should follow a man for honestly telling a woman she is beautiful." A little later, Troy says to her, "I should have been a good Christian if you pretty women hadn't made me an idolater." As in that sentence about pretty women making him an idolater, there's a hint here of the frenzied, fevered, instant gratification of love, where flattery is used by those who are lacking in moral fibre. A suggestion that flattery comes from and works on those whose moral character is not quite as steady as it should be. And that goes for Bathsheba as well, because it slowly wins her over. In fact, in a beautiful bit of description, Thomas Hardy says this about how Bathsheba's heart is finally given to Sergeant Troy. It says, "The devil smiled. For the moment was the turning point of a career. Her tone and mien signified beyond mistake that the seed which was to lift the foundation had taken root in the chink." So here we've seen already the folly of sending a valentine to someone, then the folly of perhaps thinking, well, because he's a well-to-do man and he's old enough to take care of me, and he's educated and sensible. Perhaps I could learn to love him. And now she's with this sergeant who sweeps her off her feet. And she thinks, oh, I'd much rather this. And she's turned down Gabriel Oak because he's poor. Now, initially, she was interested in no man, but now her head has been turned. So, where will her happiness come from? Will she pursue the things that are sober? Or, like the poem said, will the madding crowd's ignoble strife distract her from the things that will lead to her best well-being? Now, Sergeant Troy gives her a watch, and there's an excellent inscription inside the watch, which Thomas Hardy seems to be using to point the finger to the reader about where true love should not be found. Because in the inscription of the watch, it says, "Cedit amoribus," which means love yields to circumstance. But is that how true love should come about? Should it yield to the circumstance of sending a Valentine card to someone as a joke, feeling bad about it, being pressured into maybe one day committing to marrying them? Should it come about through the circumstance of bumping into someone charming and their use of flattery sweeping you off your feet against your better judgment? Because Bathsheba says at the end of one of the chapters, "If only I knew whether this flattery were true." So, cedit amor rebus. Love yields the circumstance. It's actually more of a warning, although the watch is given as a romantic token to her. This is where Thomas Hardy, after showing us how Bathsheba has responded to both Boldwood and to Sergeant Troy, he writes this: "We now see the element of folly. Bathsheba thought she had too much understanding to be entirely governed by her womanliness, had too much womanliness to use her understanding to the best advantage. And we could happily take out womanliness here for both sexes. How many of us, is Thomas Hardy saying, think we have too much understanding to be entirely governed by our whims of fancy, to have our head turned by trivial things, by frivolities, by follies? And yet the truth is that our trivialities and our want for immediate gratification and pleasure prevents us from using what understanding we have to the best advantage. And this is the theme that runs through and through the book. In fact, it takes about half the book before this theme becomes apparent because we're introduced to the characters on the way. In all of this time, Gabriel Oak continues to work for Bathsheba on her farm, making her farm one of the most successful in the area, and yet he never brings up his love for her again. And now we get this contrast between such a good man to the flattering Sergeant Troy. The book puts it this way: Troy's deformities lay deep down from a woman's vision, whilst the embellishments were upon the very surface, thus contrasting with homely Gabriel Oak, whose defects were patent to the blindest, and whose virtues were as metals in a mine. Now, what do we look for in life? Is it the embellishments on the surface which turn our eye, but they hide the detriment to our happiness and to the things that are truly important to us? Or are we sometimes blinded to the good in our own life and in our own loves because some people may have defects? Maybe they're not as gallant, they're not as good with their tongue, they're not as rich like Boldwood. Wouldn't that be a case, though, of following the madding crowd, the frenzied crowd running around trying to get instant gratification, rather than focusing on the sober aims of their life, which exists in the flicker? When Gabriel Oak realizes that Bathsheba Everdeen has fallen for Sergeant Troy, he recognizes that Troy is not a good sort. And he steps forward and he tells her, he doesn't say, "Marry me instead." He tells her, "Even though I have once said I've loved you, I ask you not to love this man, not to give yourself away to this man." Now think of the courage that takes. What lesson does Thomas Hardy draw? He tells us, "That is a noble, though perhaps an unpromising love, which not even the fear of breeding aversion in the bosom of the beloved one can deter from combating his or her errors." Isn't that beautiful? That is a noble, though perhaps an unpromising love, which not even the fear of breeding aversion in the bosom of the beloved one can deter from combating his or her errors. So, a true lover, even though they may lose the love of their life by telling them something that hurts them, but is true, they will still say it for the benefit of the one that they love. And this is what Gabriel Oak has. And it's what Boldwood doesn't have, and what Sergeant Troy certainly doesn't have. In fact, when Boldwood finds out that Bathsheba's heart has been given to Troy, he goes bananas. He comes to see her, he tells her that she made a promise and has gone back on it, that she was meant to be his, although she had never said anything of the sort, but she just didn't have the courage to out and out turn him down, or when she did turn him down, he ground her resistance down until she gave him some form of hope. And Boldwood, though older, wiser, well-to-do, educated, really shows that he too is part of the frenzied, madding crowd because he just really rages at Bathsheba. And it says Bathsheba, in spite of her mettle, began to feel unmistakable signs that she was inherently the weaker vessel. In other words, she was scared because Boldwood was really going at her. So again, Boldwood on the surface looked good, but did he have that thorough moral core, which is what true happiness in love is based on when both people have it? This is what Thomas Hardy is trying to get the reader to think, not how entertaining or how rich is the person that I love, but how good are they? And now we come to the absolute theme of the book. In a particular paragraph, we get this written, and I'll read it twice because it is the theme. Bathsheba, after comparing Boldwood's raging and comparing Sergeant Troy, who squanders fortunes and who doesn't show correct regard for Bathsheba and abuses her really emotionally. Through all of this, Oak sticks by Bathsheba to benefit her without mentioning his love. And then she says, well, this is what's said about him. She thinks, what a way Gabriel Oak had, she thought, of enduring things. Boldwood, who seemed so much deeper and higher and stronger in feeling than Gabriel, had not yet learned, any more than she herself, the simple lesson which Oak showed a mastery of by every turn and look he gave, that among the multitude of interests by which he was surrounded, those which affected his personal well-being were not the most absorbing and important in his eyes. Oak meditatively looked on the horizon of circumstances without any special regard to his own standpoint in the midst. That was how she would wish to be. What a brilliant summing up of the kind of person everyone should look for to love. Gabriel Oak could endure things, even though he may not show the highest and strongest feelings on the surface. He had a mastery in every look and turn, where when he looked at any event, he didn't see himself first, which Boldwood did and which Sergeant Troy did. Oak meditatively looked on the horizon of circumstances without any special regard to his own standpoint in the midst. That was how she would wish to be. Gabriel Oak was far from the madding crowd. And he hadn't strayed away from his sober wishes of being a good man, and slowly but surely, perhaps, to win the race in getting Bathsheba Everdeen's hand by being good, although he really held out no hope of doing so. Now, the story goes on, and I'm not going to give spoilers because you really must read this book. It is absolutely fantastic. But to whet your appetite and make you want to read it, towards the end, you see this change in Bathsheba from being this frivolous girl who looks in the looking glass when we first meet her and thinks of her beauty, who foolishly sends practical joke valentines to people, which get her in a world of trouble, who gets her head turned in different directions against her better judgment. But she ends, not ends, but towards the end of the book, she uses these words, "Oh, it is my fault. How can I live? How can I live?" Now, if you want to know why she says that, you need to read the book by Thomas Hardy, Far From the Madding Crowd. This has been a book review by the Classics Book Club. I'm Tristan Teed. I really hope you've enjoyed it. And if you have, please go to our website, www.theclassicsbookclub.co.uk, and send us a message and tell us what you think. Also, if you could, share this with others if you think they'd like it. Thank you very much.